This week on the Dylan Friends podcast, massive guest Craig Hutchie Hutchison. Wow, this is huge. Like, I honestly never thought I'd have the opportunity to sit down and chat with this guy. And it's honestly astonishing what he's been able to do in his career. Starting out as a young journalist working for the Herald Sun to owning SEN and owning one of the biggest companies really in Australia, the biggest sports networks in Australia. It's seriously, seriously impressive what he's been able to do. But yeah, we unpacked it all. Growing his media empire, you know, hosting all these radio stations and growing them all across Australia. And yeah, he's been a massive, I suppose, role model for me. Looking at now of what he's been able to do with his business has been nothing short of incredible, to be honest. We also touched on his journalism days and some of the things he learnt, cutting his teeth and trying to find and break stories and some of the highlights and I suppose lowlights and mistakes he made along the way that have really impacted him on his journey. But yeah, it was pretty incredible to see like his mindset on work. Like, I think after you listen to this, you'll understand why this guy is so successful. He is an absolute workhorse. It's like every single person we spoke to was just Hutchie's, his work rate and running his business is really second to none. I think it's honestly just the beginning for him. He's already done so much, but fuck, I've no idea what's next. He's buying up things left, right and centre. Cannot thank him enough for his time sitting down on our pod. And love it so much. Let's go.
My name is Deborah, Dylan's mum. Welcome to the Dylan Friends podcast.
Many ways, I've been waiting my whole life for this moment.
Tears.
Tears. Tears.
Strength.
I'm like, I run. She's like, everyone runs. I'm like, but does everyone go to the Olympics?
They're sitting there meditating, going, oh my God, I think I'm meditating. How good is this? I'm meditating.
Like, they had a Wu-Tang call. So I was like, yo, Dylan, thanks for getting us in.
Just love
it's
it.
Knuckle puck time. Yeah.
It's like don't forget to subscribe and leave a review.
Craig Hutchison, welcome to the Dylan Friends podcast, my friend. It's an honour, it's a pleasure, it's a privilege to have you on the show.
Hey, Dylan, nice to see you and hear you. How are you?
I'm very well, my friend. It's a massive treat to have you today, mate. It's a media mogul, a big, I suppose, hero of mine in this space now, you know, trying to do some podcasts and seeing where you've got to, especially with the research we've done and what you've done over the last 10 years, mate. It's been unbelievable and so, so pumped to unpack it all today.
That's not even remotely true, but thank you for the sentiment, Dylan. Look forward to having a chat.
Mate, I don't know if you remember this, but I'm hoping you don't, but we actually met a few years ago at the Emerson, and I was there at Mitch Duncan's Bucks party, and you know, I was so excited. I wanted to go up and have a chat with you, and I just realised probably at that time of the night and what I'd probably been drinking that day at a Bucks party wasn't the right time to come up and have a D&M about work life, but you're very nice and I appreciate that.
It's not too often that you hear the sentence, I'm not sure you remember this, but I met you at the Emerson, where it ends in the right manner as a sentence. But that were, it was a long time ago. But now I remember you well, and I've obviously followed your football career and been fully impressed with your foray into podcasting and the way you've connected with young audiences. So in turn, I'm actually humbled to be with you today, Dylan. Nice. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to get into it. Mate, you've, as I said, you've done it all. I think a lot of people, I know you as a journalist, I know you as the big dog at SEN, but I suppose the journey that got there, which has been what I'm most intrigued about too, is what I'd love to talk about today. It's been honestly phenomenal, and you've really set a massive standard for the Australian media. Where did it all start? You're a young kid from Warragul. How'd you get into journalism?
Yeah, I feel like my story's not that interesting, but I'll do my best version to give it a version of it anyway. So yeah, I began young, Dylan. I was a 12-year-old working in the Warragul Gazette. My dad was very fortunate to be the columnist, and he let me write under his name, and I got some early exposure. So yeah, all through my teens I wrote and I guess got involved in broadcasting a little bit and did everything from call the Warragul Trots to call the Warragul Dogs to write a column for the paper on footy and cricket and trots and races, and so classic country kid that was involved in everything in sport and had a ball. And yeah, I think, you know, I always say to young people that if I could give them any advice is start your passion early, because when by the time you get to 18 you might not be exceptional at anything, but at least you'll have done it for 5 or 6 years, and the employers will factor that into their thinking.
Is that true about your old man? There's a story that we read earlier that your dad was working as a journalist, and he would actually let you write the articles for a while under his name, and you know the editors and whatnot didn't actually know this was happening, but he was sort of giving you that real early insight into writing articles.
Yeah, my dad's name's Ken. He's a big part of the Warragul community this day. He's very much a local town guy. Loves the community. He was running the John Heenan's plumbing business as the office manager at the time, or he may have still been at Pemulwuy's, where he was for 28 years as the general manager of the store. And yeah, he did it as a bit of a hobby because he loved, like my late mother did, like loved local sport and community. So he wrote the column as a hobby, and he knew that's what I wanted to do. I was fortunate enough to know what I wanted to do at the age of 6 or 7. So he gave me a chance to write under his name for a year. And I probably didn't ever realise how important that was for me in my journey until about 10 years ago, where we did a video for one of our clients, Tobin Brothers Funerals, and I was able to tell him how much it meant to me. So yeah, he's a pretty unique guy, my dad, Kenny. He's ironically, Dylan, he's very popular and loved and inoffensive, and many would say I'm quite the opposite. So it's been, I'm not sure how that works, but he's a ripper and a big part of the Warragul community this day.
What were you like as a student, Hutchie, studying journalism? Did you study the traditional route? Was it something you just did? Did you work? Did you fall into it? How did your transition go to getting your first sort of cadetship?
As a student, I'd say I was a bit lazy because I knew what I wanted to do. I just didn't focus on anything else. So yeah, I'd get good marks in English and not so good marks in everything else. I think, you know, it was a bit of a double-edged sword, really. Like I had a view of what I wanted to do, and so I didn't put a lot of time into things I didn't want to do. And that was a bit challenging because at the end of year 12, I didn't get a first-round offer in university. So that was a confronting day when you know, those days, I'm not sure how it was in your era, Dylan, but in my day, I was like the old war story guy, the Herald Sun would have the results of the uni offers, and you'd sit there and there'd be 3 pages of them. You'd be looking through for your name, and when it's not there, it's pretty confronting as a 17, nearly 18-year-old in 1992 when you thought that you were on a journey to be, hopefully to be a journalist. So yeah, that was confronting, and I guess it probably set the tone from there, really.
Was there a turning point that kicked you into gear and made you realise that you had to knuckle down and get to work? Because from everyone we've spoken to, and this theme will come a lot today, is your work ethic is you know, second to none. It's unparalleled. It's nearly obsessive the way, you know, you work and the passion you put into things.
As a cadet at the Herald Sun, probably in 1994, when I was one of 8 or 9 cadets, I was the least equipped by a mile. Most of them had university degrees, and most of them were very considered, intellectual. I was a country kid who was, you know, trying to find my way, and the then cadet counsellor, Kim Lockwood, called me in after about 8 weeks and said, I don't think you're going to make it. You know, he said to me, and I've mentioned this before in previous interviews, that I'm off watching Lethal Weapon videos while they're studying meaningfully at night. And so I knew that really all I had from there was my work ethic. And so the next day he would get to work at 5:30 in the morning, which was abnormal to him. And so I'd try and get there at 5:15. I thought, if my journalistic dream's going to be over, at least I want to make sure the person who makes that decision has to walk past me at 5:20 in the morning and give myself the best chance. And then you get to work early and you've got to find something to do to fill the time in. So I would hit the phones and try and find stories. And when the other cadets walked in at 8 or 9 o'clock, I'd had 3 hours ahead of them, and I realised I could get published. And then just sort of that's how I kept going, really.
Unbelievable. Yeah. So it's been a theme the whole time hearing that. Journalism, though, it's something, you know, I was on the other side of journalism for a long time. Not that people wrote about me. The only time it came up in articles was at the end of the year, and they were saying this guy's getting delisted or not.
How did you find it being a subject of journalism?
Look, it really didn't affect me much. And I, one, I wasn't really written about, but two, I actually understood that when you're in the sporting eye and you're getting paid money, things are going to be written about you. Whether that's you like it or not, I think the big thing for me was when media happens, are they talking about the person or are they talking about the actions of that person? So that was probably the biggest thing that I go forward. And when I look at journalism now and when I do podcasting, and I suppose a part of my show is trying to uncover the person, find out who they are, not what the persona is. But that's been a big part for me, I think.
Yeah, I think as a subject, people take it very seriously, right? Fundamentally, people don't like being talked about unless it's positive. And that's just human nature. That is entwined with journalism as an act. And so, you know, I personally think people might tell me otherwise. I don't really care what people think unless you really respect them. Like if my dad rang me and said, you're making a pickle of yourself, I'd sit back and go, okay, fair enough. That's feedback I want to take on. But I don't really get caught too much in what other people think. And that's, I've always probably been a bit polarizing. And I suppose as a player, you're probably a bit the same, right? So you're your own man. And as you go on to your own journey in podcasting, you've done your own thing, and good on you.
Yeah, I don't think I do as well with criticism as I'd like, though. I think it's still a big part of me that I'd have to build. And I think in this day and age, like, everyone is pressed for an opinion. And if you don't have an opinion, you seem to have been this person. But I suppose I'm trying to break the mold a bit. Like, I talk about things I like and I don't talk about things I don't like. I don't feel the need that everyone has to have an opinion on everything. Yeah. Otherwise, you don't really mean it. That's when you get yourself into trouble.
Dennis Pagan used to say, listen, son, if you start arguing with fools, pretty soon people won't tell the difference.
Yeah, no, I'm very quick to disagree with people and let them have their time. Early days journalism, though, you, and this is every journalist, there is a part of that that gives me massive anxiety. Like, you are really trying to undercover stories that people might not want to hear, they don't want to hear. With that's got to come a lot of tension, I suppose, trying to break stories. Do you remember your first big story that you broke?
Yeah, I do. And I guess I have an uneasy relationship with journalism these days because it's, you know, it's shaped our business and my life. So it's been such a great thing for me over the journey, but I sound like the guy that tells the old war stories these days, and I hang the boots up about a decade ago, but I'm not certain what my view is on certain acts or parts of it that got me here in the first place, you know? So it's a little interesting conundrum for me. Yeah. My first story was, the thing that helped me was my first back page leak. I think as a young Herald Sun journalist, you want to be on the back page or the front page. And if you're in the sport division, you want to be on the back more than the front, or you hope the sports story is big enough to be on the back and the front. So there was probably a lot of things along the way, but a simple little story of a bunch of St Kilda players getting injured on a Friday night in an intra-club game where no one else was there, and we had the exclusive story and the interview with Stan Elves, the coach, and I was in the cadet group at the time, so I wasn't meant to be writing sports. So that's the one that springs to mind when you say that, but... Yeah, I'm not sure what the exact kind of first story was or whatever. My first published story, I think, at the Herald Sun was on Lee Colbert as a feature story on the young kid at Geelong, and we've maintained a relationship ever since, which has been the best part of 30 years, and it's great to see him doing great things in McDonald's in Mildura. But, yeah, they're probably the two that spring to mind.
Has there ever been, you know, stories, and I know that you're not a journalist these days, but back in the day, it's really interesting your point that you bring up, that a lot of the things you might not agree with, you know, these days, being in the position you are, but is there any stories that, you know, you've been through that stick out in mind where you go, fuck, maybe going back now, could I have done that different? Did it affect a relationship that you'd had? Or is that just what you got to do? You're there to report the news and you have to, you know, do your job.
Yeah, the one that my biggest mistake in life was the St Kilda sexual misconduct investigation, where I broke the story but had one of the two accusers wrong, and that was as big a mistake as you can make in journalism. That was the one that you look back on and regret significantly, and took me a long time to come to terms with that mistake. And, you know, there was a path to that story where, because it was my job to do the story, and it wasn't a great part of, you know, reporting on people's lives that you want to do, but it was a very real thing at the time, and got one of the names wrong, so I caused some discomfort to that particular person. And I didn't probably need to name the two accusers, Dylan, in the story. There's an argument, of course, that you're incriminating the other 38 players if you don't name the two, but, you know, that story could have been told without actually naming the players involved. I thought I was right. I had three sources. I had read to me the affidavit of the search warrant of the house and all of those things, but it turned out the person who owned the house wasn't one of the two accused, so... It was a fairly big mistake. If I had my time again, I would have handled that very differently. I think journalism is a fairly imperfect science, so you can make a lot of mistakes along the way. There's no doubt about that.
What's your relationship with the public like when you're a journalist, you think, and journalists these days? You know, we spoke to Sam McClure a while ago on the pod, and he had some incredible insights into the public. It's like, you know, the public want news. They want news. They love news, and they love hearing about it. But then when you give it to them, they instantly don't like the news and they don't like the journalists. It's sort of, you know, they want the news, but they don't want it from someone.
That's entirely true. And I guess that's just human nature. And we're all victims of that. We all denounce something we read in the paper, but we all click on the website to read it in the first place. We have a podcast that we make called Don't Shoot the Messenger, which is Caroline Wilson's favourite saying, and one that we've turned into a podcast, but that is entirely true when it comes to journalism. You really deal with debit points rather than credit points in the journalistic eye. If you're breaking stories, you're going to upset people, and that's just life. And so, yeah, it's the public view of a journalist is somewhere between a dodgy lawyer and a used car salesman when you're in the news business. It's very hard to rise above that. And if you do, and you do lots of things, all journalists do lots of things that protect people, but because of that very nature, that's never known. So you're only judged on the things that hurt people.
Yeah.
And It's not until you're a columnist or a feature writer where people might pay you greater claim or respect because you've told positive stories or you've delved deep into things that have meaning. And there's only a small percentage of journalists that get to do that in the first place, whereas a lot of people cutting their teeth have got to break news stories. And again, you're only seeing a portion of what they know, and the things that they've turned a blind eye to, protected or overlooked or cut a deal on, you don't know. So you don't understand the emotional, the human side of that from behind. So yeah, I think journalists get a broad deal at most probably, but with that said, they do make a lot of mistakes too. So it's a tough one.
In your eyes now, going back to when you're a journo, if you look at it now in this modern day, you know, 2021, 2022, would you say it's similar to that? Would you say it's harder to become a journo now? Would you want to be going back and trying to find stories? Is it just so overrun now that there's stats all the time saying there's two or three journalists to each player in the AFL?
Yeah, I think, well, there's probably a couple of parts to that. These days you compete with the recipients. That didn't really happen in my day. So these days, if I had a story, say I was a young journalist right now, I had a story about Hawthorn. If Hawthorn know I have the story, they're more inclined to publish it themselves and benefit from the news on their own platforms. So you're almost gun shy to share what you know with the recipient, because often the recipient is a competitor. All 18 clubs have got a .com. The AFL have got a .com. You're almost, the ability to delve deep into a story is tougher because everyone's a publisher. So that, I would find that hard. I reckon that'd be really tough for the young brigade coming through. Equally, a good story is a good story, and these days you can magnify it more, or you can, the cross-platform nature of a story. I think the world of Twitter's been an unbelievable news product, and the cycle just moves so quickly. And I think there's a lot of people that live in a fairly safe place in journalism these days. Not a lot of people take chances. So the Sam McClure, who you spoke about before, he's one of those who takes great chances and actually, you know, breaks stories and has some flair about his newsmanship. And you know, you can stand out a bit more these days because there's not as many people who are having a real genuine go at being different. But you can, if you live near the cliff occasionally, you can fall off from time to time.
Yeah, no, you can. And you're right about Sam. He's doing incredible things. Mate, you're talking about earlier about writing stories and doing your research at a young age. And I suppose when you're working on a story, I can imagine these take so long to do. You're investing in this in months. You've got your scoop. You want to go and get it. You're investing into it. How do you know someone else isn't actually working on that story the same time as you? Do you know someone else isn't working on the same story at the same time as you? And do you want to get all the research done, or are you trying to be there to be first?
You know, I always used to think of it like an hourglass. Like the minute you found out about something, sand starts falling out of that process, and there's the opportunity for someone else to do it before you. There's nothing, every journalist in the world would tell you the same thing, Dylan. There's nothing worse than knowing something and being beaten to it when you knew it because you weren't nimble enough to get to the line in the first place. So I think time, from the second you learn something that you believe is true, time becomes a thing. In those days, I'm, again, telling war stories here, but in those days, you had to wait to the place you could publish, which in my instance was the Evening News or previous to that, the next day's paper, whereas now it's about by the minute on digital and social and those environments. So any time more than, say, four or five people know about something, there's a fairly reasonable chance it gets out. You know, the more people that know, the pass-the-parcel nature of news is enormous. So I always think, how many people would know this? And the answer is three. Okay, you're pretty safe. If the answer's 33, and they come from different businesses, like it was, to give an example, it was shared at a room or a meeting or a conference. You know, the CEOs were briefed on this. Time is of the essence. You must move.
Huge. Yeah, it's. I can imagine it being race to the first. Hutchie, I've heard you in a couple of interviews speak about this, so hopefully you can tell us a story today. But your relationship with Gerard Whateley, obviously a massive impact on you and your career. I've heard a story about you guys back in the day working together, and your relationship was frayed for a few years thereafter. Are you happy to tell us that story?
I've probably told it too many times. He's probably sick of me telling it, so I don't want to back over it necessarily too much, other than to say we saw things a little bit differently on a day when we were competing on 7 versus 10 in the day. And, you know, I probably manipulated the situation a little bit to my advantage and being a competitor, and he didn't understandably love it at the time, and we didn't speak as often. He was always courteous and friendly, but you know, obviously it affected our close friendship at the time because I'd taken advantage of a situation, and I think we both would have, or certainly I would have handled it a little bit differently. The competitor in me at the time probably makes that decision, most of that decision the same way, but it depends what day you get me, I guess. Like it was a moment where you had an opportunity to break a story and to capitalise on a situation. So I didn't tell a lie on the day, but I certainly didn't reveal the truth. He is exceptional at what he does. Feel so fortunate to work with him. We've been able to reconnect years later, and we've built a great partnership from a radio perspective. He does an incredible job at fronting our network. His program is superb, but just the way and the manner he and his wife Claire are towards our business and the way that they represent our company from a public market sense is superb. And yeah, I think it's exceptional what he does. He's very considered. He's smart. He works hard. You know, we couldn't be happy with the job he's doing. And that was a long time ago in a bygone era.
Appreciate you opening up, mate. I know it's hard to open up old wounds. When did Hutchie go from journalist to businessman? This is what I'm most excited about, because in the industry now, I know how hard it is, and can't imagine, you know, doing what you've done. Was there a pivotal moment where you thought, fuck, I'm going to change my tune here and actually start the business myself?
Yeah, it was probably around 2005. So I was 30 or 31, had gone pretty hard at things for most of my 20s. I was a bit crash through, and I was spent. And had itchy feet and went to America and I guess started doing radio crosses from there and syndicating in a weird way, kind of half syndicating myself back to stations in Australia to talk about American sport, and then having to find a sponsor, and not a dissimilar journey to the one you've been on in creating your own content and finding your own partners and those type of things. And so that was where it kind of began as an idea. And then I met a guy called James Swanick, who's same age as me. He was an LA-based Australian, great friend. He was in the celebrity journalism game, and he was similarly at the same point, his stale. He wanted to do something different. And so we were sharing our frustrations to each other, I guess, over his barbecue and backyard basketball ring in Los Angeles at the time, where I was partially living in New York. And we came up with an idea to start a business together. And so that some of the, you know, parts of our world that we were doing, my radio crosses, his stories to the UK on journalism, came into the business, and we started working what our offering was, I guess, and that's where it began. And that's where it's continued to be since.
What was the vision? I find it hard to believe that you could have visioned exactly what you've done now as it played out further than what you thought it would be. What was the initial vision of what you thought the Croc Media would be at that stage?
Well, our first two products were public relations for Australian companies in America, and that was, I wouldn't have thought that was a great success. And the second part was, we're back in PR now, but it's taken a fair circle to get back here. And the second part was television distribution, so finding TV distribution for Australian product outside of Australia. And I think Rex Hunt's fishing series was one of those products that we took on early, and we had a little run where we owned the National Lacrosse League rights around the world. But again, that wasn't a great success either. And it wasn't until the third product, which was radio and radio syndication, where we found a little bit of a niche for ourselves regionally. We began in four towns in regional Victoria, and we grew. And now we're heard on 291 frequencies in Australia and 28 in New Zealand. And we own 50 radio stations, I guess, call it, in terms of frequency. So, yeah, it's been a 15-year run to then. I think what you find in business, and many people who've in the startup game, and you'd have a lot of startup people following your product, Dylan, because you have high appeal in that sector, is fear just drives you. You're in survival mode early. You test and learn all the time. And sometimes your clients end up pushing you into areas that ultimately, as a business person, you're there to solve your client's problems. And ultimately, your clients sometimes have problems that are outside your skill strength. So you need to go and hire people or find ways to solve those problems. And so when, not dissimilar to anyone else, we've ended up in the areas that I probably wasn't an expert in, because our clients along the journey have asked us to help solve a problem in those areas, and we've been able to kind of skill up and find people that could.
You just alluded to it then, but you know, obviously SEN is an absolute powerhouse in Australia and New Zealand now, but I can imagine it wouldn't have all been smooth sailing. Like, was there times where you're just like, fuck this, like, this is too hard to do. Like, it can't be done.
No, I was never defeatist, but it got really challenging at times. Like, there's periods of business life where you've got to figure out and find a way when there doesn't seem like there is one. It took us 11 years to own a radio station, so it was a long time. Like, radio is only one of, we're in about 12 different products. Radio is one of the 12, but it took us 11 years to own our first station, which was 1116 SEN. So that was a fairly big journey as a supplier to become an owner of a station. And so, yeah, it was hard. Like, there were times when you thought, what's the next step and where's the path? But we were equally very lucky. We had always had very talented people to work with us, and we always had great clients. And, you know, there were good days and bad days, but, I never kind of lost sight that there was a future for us if we worked hard enough. And ultimately, if you work hard in life, you can pick your own path. Like, hard work is the panacea to most problems.
How did the vision come, though? Like, again, you're a journalist at this stage. You're 30. You've come a long way, obviously. But the business now, was that just learn on the go? Did you have some incredible mentors along the way that were able to help you? Or did you literally just go head first and think about it later?
Bite off more than you can chew, Dylan, and chew like crazy. And that was kind of our philosophy at the time. And, yeah, I just feel like, looking back, I've always felt uncomfortable in these interviews because it sounds like you've achieved something. I don't feel like we've achieved anything yet. But looking back, I was very fortunate. There's some great people along the way who are still with us who have helped enormously in our team. And, you know, as you get a bit bigger, it gets a bit easier to find talented people. When you're younger, it's hard to attract talent to your business because they're looking at you going, is this business going to work? And, you know, are we going to be any good? And so, like, it's not, you know, it's not easy. But as Dennis Pagan again used to say, Dylan, if it was easy, everyone would be doing it. So you got to find a way to outwork people, and that's all we've kind of ever done as a team, I think.
Would it be fair to say that, you know, just from this short chat now, and this is obviously a compliment, but it feels like you're addicted to, like, that hard work and addicted to the drive?
There's worse addictions to have than being addicted to your business. Most addictions are negative. Some people would say I'm a little too addicted to the detail in our business, but it means something every day. Like, it's a privilege but not a right to be in a business like ours where you can produce content every day, you can entertain people, you can drive scale into your clients, and it can help solve their problems from a marketing sense. You know, that's a privilege, not a right. No one's to say it's going to be there tomorrow, the next week, or next year. And equally, you've got to adapt as, like, media has moved and changed significantly. So you have to move and change with it and often ahead of it, because we are a client-led business and you need to be able to solve clients' challenges and you need to be able to be where the people are. So that's addictive because you need to be. If you take your eye off it, it's something you can't take your eye off for a minute. It's a seven-day-a-week business. It's not easy, and it's not plausible to have a day off even if you wanted to. So, you know, that's fun. It's great. There's days where you love it more than others, but, you know, it's a great privilege.
Staying on top of things as well, you just said then, like, you got to stay ahead of the curve. And forgive me, I don't know how this works, but is this, like, why SEN would be buying up media assets? Is that why you're sort of moving into New Zealand? You've got SEN South Australia. You've got the footy record. You're with the Perth Wildcats. Like, are these decisions to, you know, help the future? Is that what it is, basically?
Yeah, and also that we're a public business now. So 3.5 years ago, we became a public market. If for anyone listening out there, you can have a look at our stock. We're unbelievably great value at 25 or 6 cents today. That's the same price we were at the time we went in, and yet we've done so much and we've scaled so much. So, you know, from a public markets perspective, I think we're an incredible opportunity. We trade under SEG on the stock market, and you can download the SEN app if you haven't heard any of our content. You get a different experience in every part of the country, both Australia and New Zealand. It's tailored to your area. But yeah, it's not my money. It's public money. I'm one of the shareholders. But there are a lot of people who are shareholders of the business who would expect their CEO to drive the business forward, to grow it, to scale it, and to be a meaningful and tangible business for the years to go. Our turnover is, you know, circa 3 or 4 times what it was when we began the merger journey. And I think we're, you know, an unbelievably solid business now, for well positioned for a long run at things in the future. But if I was a shareholder in our business and wasn't working in it, I'd be expecting that too of the leader of it. So I understand it from that point of view.
being as big as you've got and just mentioning it then, it's phenomenal. You've done an incredible job. But something that I think you have to be able to do to be a boss and get as big as you have is you've got to, you know, step on people's toes. You've got to make, you've got to disrupt the market, really. How hard was that for you, or was it easy building a big business? Did people, you know, other competitors be scared of what you were doing? Was it something that ever crossed your mind when you were building the business? Did you worry about what other people were thinking?
Well, I didn't really for the first decade, because we were off building something regionally, ostensibly. We began in regional Australia and we grew back into the cities, which makes us a little bit abnormal. Most businesses see regional as a secondary market. For us, it was core, and no one was really out doing it regionally. So it didn't feel like we were in anyone's way. As we grew a bit, perhaps others thought that of us, but for a long time they didn't. And for a long time it was under the radar, a little bit of, you know, a capital city market. So we've always just done, we don't see ourselves as having any competitors. We supply most people, and we have lots of kind of intricate relationships that are not always clear from the outside, but we don't view ourselves as having any competitors. Others would potentially think that of us, but we, on hand on heart, we just get up and try our best to solve problems. And if we can solve the problem ourselves, we will. If we need to work with someone else to solve a brand's problems, we will. Yeah, you know, we'll strike deals with external companies all the time. So that's, and then from the hard nose point of view, I think you need to be able to make strong decisions. That's not perhaps natural in me growing up, but I think I've got better at it. Like if you need to make a hard call, you got to make it. It's not personal. One of the weird things about media, Dylan, is that it's a very emotional business, because if you're an accountant or a lawyer, potentially, what you do on a Monday at 3 o'clock isn't necessarily debated the next morning over the breakfast table or at dinner that night. Whereas if you make a hard talent call or a content call, everyone's got an opinion on it, and some people agree and some people disagree, but there's a running commentary on it. And I think footy clubs go through the same thing. You would have done that and experienced that in your time at Carlton and the Giants. So yeah, so that is the job. The seat requires you to make hard calls, and you know, hopefully I got a little bit better at it over the time, but I haven't always made the perfect call all the time and the right call. And it's very subjective. If we named 10 content shows or talent right now, we'd have different views on it ourselves, and so would the people listening. That's a subjective business.
Yeah, I can't imagine those big calls and making massive calls. As you said, in the media, everyone's going to always have an opinion on things, which makes it hard, and that's why the media is the media. The sports media in the future, in the near future, you just mentioned before, you've always got to be ahead of the curve. What does it look like to you? And do you actually pay notice much of digital media, like new media, like YouTubing, yep, podcasting, TikTok, Instagram, socials? Is that something that you guys look into at SEN, or are you more focusing on the commercial media that's a lot bigger?
100%, yeah. So our digital focus has been huge. We've got an in-house product team of 15, call it, of just actually product men and women who focus on distribution and innovation. And that's been an agenda that we've tried to run for the last several years. We've got between 6 and 10 of the top 100 podcasts made in Australia, depending on the month. You know, I think in sport, we've got the lion's share of that market, and we coexist against many great podcasts. Digital video as a business, I think the attention spans are getting shorter and shorter. You've got to be in snackable content. You've got to be in short form content. You know, we're circa 10, 12 million video views a month as a business, and it's all 60 second, 90 seconds. We have a YouTube channel, which is a little bit longer. It's probably 6 minutes rather than 90 seconds. You know, obviously, Snapchat and TikTok have been transformative products and appeal to younger generations. YouTube kids live on. So you've got to try and be in everything, don't you? And you've got to try and build your brand through all those areas and have products that appeal to them all. But equally, traditional media has clearly been where we've been able to grow. And, you know, regionally, and even AM licenses we've been able to make something of for different communities and sectors around regional Australia in particular. So, yeah, I'm always looking. I'm not an expert on anything, but test and learn is a great way to try things, and sometimes you just got to try things.
What's the biggest growth area, you think, in the media in general? Is it these new age medias, or is it actually nailing what's already there? Personally, I feel like at the moment we've never, you know, consumed more content in our lives. COVID, it's probably the only industry that's really dominated so much from actually having news and sport and podcasting and videos just access to 24/7.
they're not mutually exclusive. Like, I think you've got to be able to distribute your content in many ways, and you've got to be able to connect with people in all walks of life. You know, our aspiration is someone wakes up on a Saturday morning, consumes us in five different ways before they get to the ground, and then consumes at the ground in five different ways. Now, that's, we want to be part of the content funnel for a sports fan. And I think, you know, the melting pot of humour, irreverence, pop culture, sport, even adjacencies like, you know, politics and, you know, modern day life, they're all, there's a melting pot going on there that's, you know, driving consumption to the left, which is a bit more irreverent. And that extends out to memes and GIFs and whatever else you want to call it, and a clever ways to launch your fixture and cats howling and everything in between. And then over to the right, opinion is always going to be a big product. And I've been big on opinionists and their ability to cut through over the journey and, you know, having a strong opinion. If you look at global opinionists like Stephen A. Smith and others, they've got such huge currency because of the way they distribute their content. And often they're as well known as the subjects they're talking about. So they're the, and then the third part is the linear experience, which is the live event and how it's broadcast. I find that really interesting. We've had radio rights and television rights in many things, but then, you know, experience is where you haven't got rights, but you're part of the companion process. SEN Track is a good example of that. If those of your audience who haven't consumed it can go to our SEN app and click on one of our 15 SEN Track stations, and it doesn't have racing rights, but it is a companion to the fan while they experience it as another, like most of our listeners have got Sky or racing.com or their phone on at the same time watching the race and their sound down listening to us. So, you know, it's, you've got to be part of every area of media to be part of the solution, I think, for the fan, and then you've got to be able to connect a brand to it in a meaningful way.
Stephen A. Smith, you just mentioned then about that US factor, and obviously you're a big fan of the US, you love getting over there. Is that something that you feel that obviously SEN is doing exactly that, and it does it really like no one else in Australia? How far off do you think we are to being on par with the US in terms of our sports coverage?
Well, probably never. We don't have the scale, so they're 20 times the size, and we don't have the volume of sports that are relevant. You know, NBA is every day. You know, NFL's seasonal but highly popular. You know, baseball play every day. So, like, it's, and college is huge. So, yeah, we'll never get to that level of fanaticism. But what I find it does, Dylan, is it sparks great thinking. There's so much energy around sport in America and fanaticism and the way the content's consumed. And I find it quite liberating and creatively stimulating that when you're there, because it's not the idea that you think you can pinch. It's just the thought bubble that you see and you say, oh, that won't work in Australia, but hey, maybe a version of that might, or that reminds me, I should try this. Or, you know, I find it quite, particularly places like New York and LA and Chicago, they're quite stimulating places to experience sport. And you can come home and have 15 ideas and maybe one of them works and 14 doesn't. But I think I've missed most about the last 18 months or 2 years is not being able to be in America and, you know, try things.
Was this part of the decision as well to expand into New Zealand? What was behind that?
Well, I think I've always been looking for a way in. Like, it's 5 billion people. It's 25% of the Australian population. It's a sport-loving nation. I would argue they're even more parochial about their sport than Australians are, and their national teams in particular. And then there was a gap there. There was a market that hadn't probably been nourished in being given enough sport and, you know, enough places. There was no 24/7 sport on the radio. So SENZ was a dream of ours and something we wanted to do. We're very proud of it. It's early days. You can get on your SEN app and download and have a listen to the channels. There's 28 stations. You know, we've opened offices early days in Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch and Dunedin. And it's a build, but it's a lot of fun. And equally, we get to work with very talented people, Brendan McCullum, Israel Dagg, Kirsty Stanway, Ian Smith, Mark Stafford, Stephen Donald, Grant Elliott, a whole lot more. So, yeah, it's been a lot of fun early, Dylan.
Now, Craig, hopefully you agree with me on this. I think it is. But in the US, a lot they do a lot of live streaming. So Joe Rogan does a lot. They stream themselves watching the UFC, stream themselves watching the soccer, the football, whatever it is. Is that something that you could see coming to Australia soon? And it gives, you know, people so much more aspects and so much more content to be able to consume their footy. At the moment, like you said, there's radio, there's TV, but these other facets that you're looking at, there isn't a lot at the moment.
Yeah, streaming's enormous here already. Like it's probably overpopulated already, early days. It's a technology that everyone's embraced and new. But yeah, like the, you know, Gogglebox did it in from a television sense, right? There's people, that was a bit ironic for me because I was hosting the footy show and being outrated a little bit at the time by Gogglebox, which was people watching the television as opposed to being on it yourself. So there's voyeurism is a thing. Streaming lends itself to that. That will continue to grow. You've got an element of your audience that are voyeuristic in your podcast. And yeah, so I think streaming's, you know, it's going to be an arms race. There won't be as many left on the dance floor at the end as there is now, but you know, the global streaming and then watching people watch sports going to be, you know, I think there's something really interesting in that. People, my belief is that people want to feel part of a community. Yeah. And so, you know, they want to feel like they're part of a club, you know, that if they're watching sport together or they're watching someone they all respect watch sport or somewhere in between. And that's, you know, that's the secret sauce.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. It's what we've found with podcasting and radio. I know, you know, you'd know that, but being a part of something is what everyone earns for. Lastly, just on yourself, back to your work ethic. Now, I know it's unparalleled. I know you love it, but is there a way that you find balance in life? Like, what is it? Can you pull yourself away? How does Hutchie take time for himself? Is there something you do to get away from work, or is it something you're still working on? Because I know that's something that I'm still working on personally myself.
Most people who know me say I'm very, very poor at it. So that's a continual challenge, Dylan. I think, you know, clearly in the last few years I've settled down. I've got a partner, Claire. I've got two stepkids, Nicholas and Ava. That's been pretty cool. And Nicholas and I are very tight, in particular, an 11-year-old who loves his basketball and sport, and we hang out. And, you know, Claire's been a great influence. And then I guess historically travel was my exit. But I think if you're in business and you try and make your work your life and your life your work, and you know, pretty soon you've got one integrated life where they're not different. I don't personally not craving switching off, or and you can't even if you try to, but it's different versions of integrating your family or your travel into your experience.
Yep. No, I agree. I think when you work and you're working hard, you enjoy it, but for me as well, fuck, I need to switch off sometimes. It gets too much. Is it true, though, Kachi, you don't drive anymore? Because you do get so intertwined in your work that you honestly forget that you're driving most places and you leave your car everywhere. Now, we've had a mutual friend here that said that she's had to bail your car out that many times from places because you've been so switched on with work that you've just left it at the airport.
A big cheer out to Janine, who would have told you that, my former colleague and one-time EA from a long time ago. But, yeah. When Uber came to Australia, I was the first one to sign up. I'd experienced it in America, and I always found driving, for me, I was always trying to do two things at once and concentrate on the phone call I was on or the job I had. And so, yeah, I decided to be an Uber guy a long time ago, and that's worked out pretty well.
What's next for you, Hutchie? It seems like you've done so much, but I can't imagine you wanting to slow down anytime soon. What's the big goals you've got planned?
We've got a lot of work left to do, Dylan. So we've got so many radio licenses that we haven't yet, you know, really grown into or fully. There's a lot of blue sky in our radio business. There's a lot of blue sky in our television business. Our event business is growing. Our TV business, I mentioned, is growing. Our talent business is growing. You know, our recent acquisition of the Wildcats has got a lot of work to do. So I feel like the next 3 to 6 months are about a harvest and try and consolidate and try and focus on those new areas. And then, you know, we'll look at what's next. But you know, we clearly want to build a scalable business from a sport perspective, which, you know, is a full solution for fans and a full solution for brands, and that'll continue to be the focus.
Which one are you most excited about?
I love all the things we do. Like, it's everything's a challenge. We haven't really ever been in areas where we've been. The Wildcats is the first thing I can think of in a long time where we've inherited something that's already wildly successful and very popular, and our job is to enhance it. We've been builders. And they've gone about trying to build things ground up and be part of a journey and win an audience over. And yeah, so like whether it be New Zealand, Perth, Southern Queensland and the challenge there, Sydney and how to make 1170 bigger and bolder and more socially relevant or everywhere in between, I get excited about the regional towns we're going into, whether it be Mildura or Warrigal or Gosford or Wollongong, and the offices we've opened in Bunbury. And yeah, so it's all fun. Like, you wouldn't do it if it wasn't fun. The word you used before was addictive, and I think you're right. You know, it's a hopefully a healthy addiction, but we do want to be relevant in every town we do business in. And so, you know, I'm as interested in Wellington as I am in Kalgoorlie and everywhere in between.
Just on that, with the Wildcats, acquiring a team is very impressive, and it's huge. But in the AFL, we don't see it because obviously the AFL owns all the teams. Do you ever see the fact that we could maybe have a way that AFL teams are privately owned one day in the future? Do you see that happening?
Yeah, I think it'll work, and it'll work particularly in the development markets because it'll be someone else's risk and someone else's energy, and you know that there's an argument. I don't know if it's a valid one or not, that people that owned a development team would put more time, effort, and energy into it than the league would themselves, right? Because it's bigger risk and bigger reward and bigger investment. So yeah, I'm a believer in it. I think it'd work in places like Tasmania and the Northern Territory and New Zealand from an AFL perspective. And you know, I think we'll see. You know, it's worked in the NRL. I think we'll see more and more. You know, the private ownership wins around sport are huge. It's everywhere. So, you know, our experience with Melbourne United as a minor shareholder and the Wildcats as 100% owner has been a tremendous one. And you know, sports we will keep looking at unquestionably, you know, and teams if there's opportunities to be relevant in communities.
Hutchie, mate, it's been unbelievable. I can't imagine, believe how much we've just covered, mate. I'm sure everyone's a smarter person for listening to that one today. Cannot thank you enough for your time. You've done some incredible things, and yeah, it's really exciting and honoured to have a chat, mate. Yeah, in all honesty, you've been a really big impact on me and what we're trying to do here. So congratulations, and hopefully we can catch up soon. I'd love to buy you a beer.
Dylan, well done on everything you're building with Dylan Friends. It's been an incredible journey for you. You've done an amazing job of winning people over. Your authenticity shines through. You know, clearly, you're of great character, and you've got a great team around you with all the great people you've been able to assemble to make the band work together. And yeah, I just love seeing the progress you're making, and I'm very humbled that you'll have me on your program. And thanks for the opportunity. And don't forget to download and listen to the SEN app.
We love it. Hey, by the way, just quickly, Hutchie, you said off air that you were the actual real creator of the List Clogger term. Can you quickly fill us in on that? Because that's obviously one of our other shows. And are you going to be taking legal action on us?
It's already in the hands of my lawyers, and the equally untalented Daniel Gorringer in my sights. So, and I'm only joking. The Monday morning footy classified, it was my outlet for years. We had a production meeting at 10 o'clock and we'd all bounce in, and you know, it was an hour where you could talk about the footy, and in a normally busy, my Mondays are 15, 16 hours, sort of 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. So that was the hour where I'd vent a little bit and you'd talk about footy, and we'd always try and come up with a term that stuck. It was a bit of a private joke with Gary Lyon and I, and we'd introduce a term to the program and see if it stuck. And, you know, we were talking about those players on lists that get a game because they're good enough to play, but they hinder your progress because you can't. They take 22 games off someone who might end up being an A grader, and they're a B or a B minus or a C plus. And they almost, I made reference, they clog your list. They're good enough to play, but they clog the list. And so we came up with the term list cloggers, and we mentioned it ad nauseum on the show. And we were generally hoping it would catch on. So it was like one of those private jokes where you go, is this a word where it could stick? And we used it for a couple of weeks in a row, and then lo and behold, you've got a podcast called List Cloggers. So, quite funny.
Appreciate it. You've done some good things, even giving us a name. Mate, to finish up, is there any advice you'd give Dylan Friends and List Cloggers in the future? You've been there, you've done it. What would you say to some up-and-comers that are trying to take it over?
I'm no expert. I just keep doing what you're doing. Take some risks, take some chances, be authentic with your audience, and work hard. The harder you work, the luckier you get.
Love it, mate. Thank you so much for your time. I know how busy you are. Really appreciate it. And anytime we can return the favour, we'd love to do so.
Dylan, you'll be hearing from my lawyers. Thank you.
If that wasn't enough for you and you want even more, you're in luck. Dylan Friends is now on Patreon. Dylan Best Friends. If you'd like to learn more, you can head to patreon.com/Dylan Friends, or you can head to the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening to the Dylan Friends podcast. If you like the show, it'd be a massive help if you could like, follow, rate, leave a review, or even share with your friends. The show is produced by myself and Sam Bonza. Damon Jackman from Creative Edge Films is responsible for audio and visual production. The show is recorded at the Dylan Friends Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you'd like to get in touch or suggest a guest or advertise with the Dylan Friends podcast, please email us at inquiries@dylanfriends.com. Thanks so much for tuning in.